where I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long ways of...
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, everybody. This is Shane R. Monroe, and you are listening to Retro Gaming Radio, November 2011 edition. Well, welcome to the show. We have a lot to talk about, but before we get started, I do want to address some of the pleas we have received from some of our listeners, our fans. We've been asked for better access to the archives and the link list and some of the other things for the archived shows. And we are definitely working on that. We're also going to enhance the RGR experience, the RGR Plus TV experience. It seems that some people believe that there should always be video going, and so they click on the RGR Plus TV, and they see a Please Wait video being shown, and as the show plays, they're not seeing any video, so they think there's something broken, and they're not watching it. That video is synchronized video with the show. If there's nothing to see, the video will simply sit there in a please wait state. There will be a different sort of a indicator soon. I'm still trying to work around the HTML5 code for this. But you will be able to see when the next video clip should start playing. That way you don't think that there's something broken. RGR Plus TV is always the best way to listen to the show and to experience the show. For those of you who are still listening to the audio-only version, you've definitely got to check that out. Hey, for those of you who are big audio fans, we are running Retro Gaming Radio, the classic edition of the show, from 1998 to 2005 in a complete random rotation on the RGR Plus Shoutcast, right? So go to shoutcast.com, search for Retro Gaming Radio, and you can listen to the classic Retro Gaming Radio episodes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with no interruption from other shows. And at some point, we're going to be doing a dual-screen radio marathon in December. But my producer, Alex J. Lopez, will be happy to share that information once we have it put together. So, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can listen to the classic Retro Gaming Radios. All right, that takes care of the intro stuff. Let's move on to my editorial commentary this month, The Cloud, Good or Bad for Retro Gamers. Now, for those of you who don't understand what the cloud is, all right, the cloud is a remote destination on some other computer, Google, Yahoo, Amazon, Microsoft. Another computer somewhere on the planet has a hard drive that is storing your content, be it your contacts, your documents, whatever. There's tons of examples of cloud computing. For example, Google Docs, right? If you write something on Google Docs, your document is stored in the cloud, which you can then retrieve anytime you feel like it. Dropbox is another great example of the cloud. You designate files, it echoes them up to the cloud, so then you can have access to those files anytime you feel like it. Now, why the cloud over, say, sharing stuff on your computer, right? To me, that's never really made a lot of sense. I have a computer. It's online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and even, you know, 8 hours a day when I'm not using my computer, yet I'm still paying for internet access, it would seem logical to me that all of my server-type services, storage and music streaming and video streaming and whatnot, should all be done on my own computer. It's my hardware. It's sitting idle if I'm not there, and I'm paying this big fat cable pipe. Now, it's amazing to think about, just from a little segue perspective here, exactly how much money or savings that the cable companies or your internet service providers are saving by essentially your house being dark 8 hours a day, right? You go to work, your wife goes to work, your kids go to school, your house is an internet void for 8 hours. Right? That's 8 hours that they're not providing you with service. So what you're really paying for is the 8 hours a day that you're actually using your computer. So why do we really need a cloud? Well, the cloud is for people who don't want to spend the time, effort, or energy into coming up with their own hosting, storage, and production of their own content for their own use. I, for example, use something called Subsonic. Subsonic is an audio-video streaming system I install on my computer. I can hit it from anywhere, my cell phone, my web at work, you name it. I can hit my computer and I can listen to my entire MP3 collection anytime. I can look at any of the videos or the movies that I've got stored on any hard drive in my house. It's fantastic, right? What do I need the cloud for? What do I need Google Music for? What do I need Amazon MP3 for when all of my stuff is sitting on my extremely cheap hard drive, right? I can get 2 terabytes for practically nothing. So what's the purpose of the cloud? Why is there a cloud? The cloud is 7-Eleven. This is exactly my point. The cloud is 7-Eleven. You could go to Albertsons on your way home, or Safeway, or whatever your big grocery store is, but you'd have to go out of your way. You'd have to wait in line. Now, you could get a gallon of milk at Albertsons for $1.57. It's on sale this week. Or you could go to 7-Eleven, or Circle K, or what are some of the other ones? I'm not sure what the other ones are around the country, but those are the ones that are around here. Or you could go in there for $2.99. Actually, milk's a lot more expensive at a convenience store. I don't know if you actually had to do that recently. But let's say for the sake of argument that you do that, you're talking about spending somewhere about $4 for a gallon of milk. Right? But they still sell it, right? There's milk in the, if you go to 7-Eleven to get a cup of coffee or a soda, there's milk in the fridge, right? So somebody's using this service. Somebody is using 7-Eleven to buy milk. That's the convenience factor. That's why there's a cloud instead of everybody banding together and saying, why am I paying $20, $30, $40, $60, $80 a month for internet access? Why do I have a computer sitting at home that's on that's absolutely doing nothing during the day? Well, that's part of the problem, right? The cloud is convenient. The cloud is what everybody's on. The cloud is what everybody wants to be on because they don't want to take the time or effort to research and figure out what a solution is that they could use on their own. Now, how does the cloud impact gaming? There's something called OnLive that is attempting to remove ownership 100% from gaming. And as you know, around here at Retro Gaming Radio, that's a big no-no. We want to own our games. We don't want to rent them. We don't want to borrow them under license. At some point in time, heaven forbid, we might actually want to go back and play those games again. Not tomorrow, not next week, but maybe next year, next decade. You know, we're retro gamers. We're still playing crap from the 70s and 80s here, right? So don't think for a second that we may not want to find a game that we purchased today and go back and play it again in a decade, right? That's going to happen for us. So this online service essentially lets you rent access to their cloud. They've got a supercomputer or supercomputers, highly evolved hardware for each and every player that they bring online, or they have some sort of a shared system. My point is with any television, with any little box, you plug a controller into this box that plugs into the internet, and you can play Halo, you can play Call of Duty, you can play any of these top-notch AAA titles without owning a console and without owning a computer. Now, a lot of people are going, oh, that's awesome, that's fantastic, that solves all the problems. I don't have to keep my PC up to date. I don't have to, you know, spend money on a console I'm only going to use for one game. This is the greatest thing ever, and this is what OnLive is hoping that they will accomplish with this. Now, think of it this way. The publishers that are out there with the games think that this is the greatest thing ever. There's no chance of piracy because you never own a disc. You never have any physical media in your pocket. You don't have to worry about getting in bed with Microsoft or getting in bed with Sony or getting in bed with Nintendo in order to make these games happen for everybody. Right? And it doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter what the game was made for. It plays the same everywhere. Now, again, that sounds great, but what happens in 5 years or less, maybe more, when OnLive goes away, right? You were allowed to rent these games. You were allowed to play these games. You even got to, quote, quote, own these games. You had to pay, and by the way, you pay the same price as retail. Don't think you're going to get a good deal here, because you're not. You're going to pay the same price as retail. And these games are not yours. They are only as good as the system that's serving them. If your internet is out, if your OnLive box takes a dump, which you could of course say about your computer or your or your console as well. But if your internet goes down, if OnLive decides to go bye-bye, if you're not paying your monthly fee for OnLive, oh yeah, I forgot, did I mention that? You have to pay a monthly fee in addition to buying the games? Yeah. So if you're not paying that and you're not, you know, upgrading the hardware or doing that, or let's just say that, you decide you need to, you know, bring your internet down to, you know, a decent speed that gets you by because times are tough and you don't want to have to pay a bunch of money for a huge broadband bill. Now all of a sudden these games are cut off to you. That's how the cloud impacts gaming. There's a loss of ownership, which is huge for people like us, and there's a loss of control over how and when you'll be able to play these games. Now, let me give you an example. Let's talk about a very old and defunct system, the Sega Genesis, right? Sega CD, specifically. Sega CD used CD-based media to play what most people would consider mediocre games, but that's beside the point. For the sake of argument, I own several Sega CD games are sitting in my closet right now. Night Trap, Double Switch, handful of other ones, Tomcat Alley. Now, those games, well, to the letter of the law, I don't own them, right? Because you can't own a piece of software, you can only license it. But for the sake of argument, I own that disc, right? If I want to go and get a Sega Genesis and a Sega CD and plug it into my TV, I can play those games. If I want to drop that disc into my computer right now, into my tray, I can run an emulator and I can still play those games. I don't have to repurchase them. I don't have to pay a monthly fee. I don't have to request or beg to pay to play the stuff that I've already paid for. So the cloud is not good if what you're looking for is ownership. But what the cloud does offer is low-cost entry for publishers to push content to the consumers. Unfortunately, while this sounds good, and we're going to get to this in a minute, it's not exactly the love fest that you would think it is. Let's take a look at one of the greatest examples of cloud consumption of media on the planet. That would be Netflix, right? If you go to Netflix right now, there's a multitude of movies and television available at your fingertips for one low fee every month. Sounds like a good idea. And millions upon millions of people are using that great idea. However, I challenge you right now. Go ahead and look. I'm going to go ahead and have the RGR Plus TV send you to Netflix. I want you to type in Herman's Head. Very popular show on Fox, ran 6 seasons. One of their premier shows. Oh, well, what do you mean? No matches found, really? Well, if the cloud's so great, how come I can't have Herman's Head? If it's so cheap to market for this product, how come I don't have Herman's Head? How come there are hundreds of thousands of television programs that I don't have access to? Some of them huge names in television that you don't have access to. Let's see. Let me think of a movie that I can have you type in. Nah, nothing's going to come to mind. My point is Netflix all-inclusive? Can you get anything you want on Netflix? Of course you can't, right? And why is that? Well, Netflix has a whole bunch of different aspects of it that do not make it optimum for the global assertion of media. Right? They can't give you everything because they're under license. They don't own anything. They have to license content from everybody else. They don't own anything. Well, they'll own Arrested Development here pretty soon. But my point is all of the content that you're seeing on Netflix can be pulled at the drop of a hat, and it's not owned by Netflix. So you are under not just the regular cloud computing restrictions. You know, you have to have a full-time internet connection, you have to have software, you have to have hardware, you have to have things to watch it on, as well as pay your monthly fee, your internet bill. Oh, and then you have to have the content. Well, if Netflix has decided not to license that content, or Fox, Warner Brothers, NBC, ABC, Weinstein Company, Paramount, then the list goes on and on. If they decide not to allow Netflix to have that content, then neither do you get the content. So let's take a look at this. Let's talk about this from video games, right? Because that's what we're here to talk about. We're talking about how the cloud affects video gaming and how it can affect retro gamers. Well, as retro gamers, the sort of things that we're interested in are very small. Atari 2600 cartridges that clock in at 1.5K. We're interested in Nintendo cartridges, which are what... let's just put it this way. Everything that we're talking about is very, very small. Even disc images from, say, Sega CD or from Dreamcast, right? Defunct systems, considered retro. Even those are relatively small. When you're talking about a 500 megabyte bin file for, say, Night Trap, right, on Sega CD, or you're talking about, you know, 800 megabytes for a Dreamcast game, whatever, you're relatively talking about small content, whereas you're talking, oh, I don't know, a single-layer DVD is 4.5 gigs, a dual-layer disc is 9 gigs, right? So we're talking about relatively small files here. So let's take away the concept that, well, you know, there's too much to serve. It takes too much bandwidth to give us every retro game on the planet, right? That's obviously not the case, because they could feed you every Commodore 64 title, every Amiga title, every Atari 2600, 5200, and 7800 title. They could feed you all of that in probably a couple of hours on a decent broadband connection. All right, so that's not the problem. The realities of the cloud, which very few people seem to care about, other than those of us who want content that's not on the cloud. Listen, if you want to watch Horrible Bosses and Bad Teachers, the cloud is your friend. If you want to play Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 on your OnLive box, then, you know, the cloud is for you. But if what you want is to play, oh, I don't know, Zookeeper, if you want to play, well, you could play Robotron. Let me see, what games can you not play? If you want to play Mr. Robot and his Robot Factory on the Commodore 64, you know, I could sit here all day and list all the stuff that you're not going to play on the cloud. And why is that? Why hasn't some great entrepreneur said, listen, I am going to give you the cloud for retro gaming. I'm going to give you the cloud. Well, here's the problem. There are too many people with too many hands in the pie for it to work. Activision owns games. Atari owns games. Electronic Arts holds the lock and key to some of my favorite games ever made, like Legacy of the Ancients. All of these companies have their hand in the pie. They own the content, and if Joe Entrepreneur, who would like to bring retro gaming to the cloud, would like to have access to that, they're going to want to charge a licensing fee. And of course, that has to get passed down to the consumer, yada, 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 and things go on and on. Now, there are microsites out there that have handfuls of abandonware and, what's the word I'm looking for? Authorized old stuff, authorized retro games, let's put it that way. But the simple fact of the matter is, there's not nearly enough money to be made in it, and even if you could convince somebody to come to, you would still never own any of it. Because, you know, here's the bottom line. Let's just say, for example, Electronic Arts decided to champion the cause of the retro gamer, and they said, listen, we're going to start the Retro Gaming Cloud. That's right, the RGC. RGC, that's what we're going to call it. The RGC is going to provide you on-demand games that you can play on your computer. All you have to do is pay us $10 a month, and you can play any single game in our library. Well, what's not in the library, right? Like, pretty much almost everything is not in the Electronic Arts library. So would you pay $10 a month to play Legacy of the Ancients, Crush Crumble Chomp, maybe Racing Destruction Set? There's some of us out here that are crazy enough, we'd probably put the money up, but probably not, right? And let's put it this way, Electronic Arts is not going to actually let you download the disc images for Racing Destruction Set. They're going to provide you with this DRM, Digital Right Management front end, that will allow you to execute the games, but you'll never actually be able to take the ROM image off of that game and, say, play it on your tablet. But good news, Electronic Arts will have an app out for you that you can pay 99 cents for that will allow you to stream the games that you already own from their PC version onto your tablet. Again, you're never going to get the ROM images, and if for some reason they decide that retro gaming service is going under and they, you know, snip the tube, so to speak, on that project, all the games that you have acquired or that you would want to play from Electronic Arts are now gone. So, now, here is what I think should happen. Now, call me crazy, call me Looney Tunes. Here's what I think should happen. I think that somebody should come up with the Retro VM, the Retro Virtual Machine. And the purpose of this, it'll be HTML5, no plugins, so those people who just can't stand Flash, you know, you've got an out. The Retro VM will let you play games anywhere. It's HTML5. Works on the portable devices, works on the media devices, works on the Amazon Fire, works on the Transformer, works on your cell phone, works in your browser, works on most of your browsers. That's the solution to how do you deliver the games, right? There's no need to have a lockdown Win32 app that the Linux people can't use. There's no reason to have a lockdown app that you have to purchase extra at the App Store, right? That doesn't make any sense. So instead, we'll make it run in HTML5. Now, here's the great part. You could technically port most of these sort of gaming engines. I mean, most of these systems are pretty fixed engines, right? And there's emulator source code all over the place. So somebody could actually just add engines to the Retro VM, right? So the Retro VM now plays Atari 2600 games. The Retro VM now plays Sega Genesis games. The Retro VM now plays Dreamcast disk images. All right. Delivery method perfectly in check, right? It runs on the client system. It doesn't take a whole lot of bandwidth. It's small and it's, shall we say, platform independent, right? It sounds good so far. Now, what about the content? Well, here's the best part. The Retro VM wouldn't need the cloud. The Retro VM could actually point, thanks to HTML5, your local file system. Hey, why don't we take the Retro VM and run the server piece of it, run it in a window on my computer at home, right? I could run it as a extension in Google Chrome, or you could run it as an extension in Firefox. I don't know if you can do it in Firefox. I know you can do it in Chrome, right? You could run that, and you now have the Retro VM running on your machine delivering your games instead of using the cloud. But let's say for the sake of argument, we're going to use the cloud. How would that work, right? You could actually use the web to spider. You could spider the web to bring in all of the freebie stuff, right? Abandonware games, legal Atari 2600 public domain ROMs. All of these things could be spidered, indexed, and use the web to suck these down into the Retro VM. Now, that's not going to solve the problem of commercial software, but if the Retro VM could use your local file system as well as all the good stuff on the web, wouldn't that make sense? Because I know personally, I've got a number of Atari 2600 games kicking around. I've got a whole bunch of, shall we say, images of Sega CD games. In fact, I own a whole bunch of them. So in that case, the Retro VM would be the engine. I would provide the content, and I could get it anywhere I wanted on the internet, be it on my phone, my tablet, whatever. It'd be the subsonic of retro gaming. That's how we do retro gaming right, in the cloud. We don't use the cloud, but for those companies like, say, Electronic Arts or whomever that did want to support this Retro VM project, they could make the disk images available. Listen, is Electronic Arts ever going to make another dime off Legacy of the Ancients? It's just never going to happen. But they don't want to provide the subsystem. They don't want to have to provide the technical support. They don't want to have to provide an engine. They don't want to have to provide a service. They don't want to have to provide a cloud. All they would have to do is make these disk images available to the Retro VM. Be it your retro VM, my retro VM, the retro VM would be the solution. So, that's my solution. I'm going to complain and whine and cry about the cloud and how it cannot provide us with what we need as retro gamers. My solution, the retro VM. Make it happen, and I guarantee you that you will see developers, old developers, producing content be consumed. And if they really wanted to take it and take it to the extreme of selling this content, fine. Set up a little web-based store, 99 cents a game, download the full ROMs right to your retro VM. Sorry about the lack of DRM, but look, you're making 99 cents a hit on the thing, right? I guarantee you a bajillion people will download Racing Destruction Set and pay 99 cents for it. It'll happen. You don't have to create anything. You have no work, no effort, no risk. That's how you service the retro gamer in the 2010s, if you will. Well, I hope you enjoyed my editorial commentary, my slight rant on the cloud. Next month, we'll have another editorial commentary right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month's Bits and Bytes is a multitude of goodies sent in by listeners just like you, as well as some of the other news and information that myself and my producer, Alex J. Lopez, has uncovered on the internet over the last month. We've got quite a selection here for you, so let's get started. First up, Alex J. Lopez, my producer, sent in a great article on American Icons. It's a gallery show that recognizes classic gaming consoles for the works of art that they are. Now, this is a selected groups of body of work by Massachusetts artist Jason Brockert, who's done a series of hazy still life renderings of the 2600, the Commodore 64, the NES, and old school cartridges. And he does some other cool stuff about Star Wars and other good things. But it's very interesting to see our classic games. Because, you know, there's a huge difference in terms of how gaming art today is looked at. You know, box art and cartridges or discs or the medium that the game is delivered on holds absolutely no draw to the current body of gamers. It's really sad, you know. Boxes used to be brilliant works of art. Commodore 64 and Atari 2600. These boxes represented sometimes it was better to have the box than the game, to be quite honest with you. And to see the 2600 and the NES and cartridges immortalized as works of art is, well, pretty damn cool. Of course, if you're watching the RGR Plus TV version, we will have already promoted you there to the appropriate article so that you can see that for yourself. Really neat stuff. If anybody has any more of this sort of thing about classic gaming and artwork, I'd love to see it. Ronald Smith is one of our regular contributors to Bits and Bytes, and this month, in addition to several other articles, he sent us in something called the Ooze Box, or Uzi Box. I'm not even sure how to pronounce that. U-Z-E-B-O-X. And you'll be able to see this, of course, on the RGR Plus TV window. The Uzi Box is a retro minimalist 8-bit open source game console. And I'm reading this right off the site. It is based on an AVR 8-bit general purpose microcontroller made by Atmel. The system uses an interrupt-driven kernel and has no frame buffer, which I find kind of interesting. Functions as a video signal generator, tile renderer, and music mixing is done in real time by a background task so your game can easily be developed in C. The design goal was to be as simple as possible, yet have good enough sound and graphics to implement interesting games. Emphasis was put on making it easy and fun to assemble and program to any hobbyists. Well, that sounds cool. I mean, this is nothing I would personally do, but I know there are tons and tons and tons and tons of people that are into this do-it-yourself, put-your-own-boards-together sort of thing. So this looks actually pretty cool. I mean, it looks like it's got a whole bunch of sample code. You know, I'm looking at some of the featured games here. They've got, you know, a Dr. Mario clone and Tetris, Space Invaders, a memory game. Looks like there's a Lode Runner clone that looks really good. Tons of videos, which you may actually get to see. One depends on what Alex J. Lopez puts in the RGR Plus TV window for you. But it actually looks pretty impressive. It's a very small board. It looks like it could accept a multitude of different types of controllers. Looks pretty neat. So if you're into this sort of do-it-yourself build-it kit, and I know that many of you are, this is definitely something to look into, the Uzi box. I wish I knew how to pronounce it. Yeah, well, once again, another name I'll butcher. Ronald Smith also sent us in another sort of do-it-yourself kit called the FPGA NES. This is a complete Nintendo Entertainment System, an NES cloned in an FPGA, and I don't exactly know what that is because I'm not a technical person. But essentially, it looks like a little tiny board that has a VGA out, some sort of a speaker out type system, a couple of joystick inputs, and a whole lot of little chips on it. It looks like one of your standard as sort of NES on a chip sort of deals, but it's got a whole big workup here. They've done a bunch of reverse engineering, and they've combined a bunch of open source projects. Most of the stuff is quite honestly above my head because I'm not an electronics guy. But for those of you who are, apparently it plays Super Mario Brothers 3, which apparently is one of the harder to run games on hardware, but it's got a full breakdown, it's got lots of pictures, and I gotta admit, I mean, it's amazing how intelligent some people are, you know. I'd like to think that I've got brain or two kicking around in there, but watching people take and rebuild NESs from scratch like this just blows me away. So if you're interested in more of this, of course, we will provide you with the link there in the RGR Plus TV window. And let's move on to the next one. Ronald was also nice enough to send us a brand new Commodore 64. And I'm going to read this straight from the LinuxDevices.com website. A 21st century revamp of the classic Commodore 64 computer is now offered with Linux Mint 11, running on a quad-core Intel Core i7 processor, 2 terabytes of hard disk storage, equipped with a classically styled case and a color-matched keys. The device has modern innards that include 8 gigabytes of RAM, /PDIF, HDMI, and DVI video outputs, an eSATA port, and wireless networking. So essentially, this is another one of those brand new computers, which is essentially the shell of a computer you used to love that is actually the internals of a computer you really don't care about other than to surf the web and play Skyrim on. But this is, you know, it's nice to see that the spirit at least is kept alive, but I guess I'm tired of seeing, you know, Commodore 64s and Amigas and all this other stuff where they basically took the name and they slapped a PC inside of it. However, this might be the piece that makes it interesting. Commodore USA is again tooting the Commodore OS Vision, a custom operating system that will allow playing all 8-bit era games within seconds thanks to an emulator that can be selected from the boot device's menu. This emulator will include game ROMs, screenshots, descriptions, ratings, the company's claims. Unfortunately, I don't have any more information about that. But the good news is this brand new Commodore 64 will only set you back $1,499, which is only about a grand more than the original one set you back in the day. So, interesting enough, as a neat side project, but I don't think I've got $1,500 laying around. Still cool for those who do. New person wrote in this month, Kevin with computerspacefan.com, is happy to report us Retrocade Magazine. Now, I took a look at the website here, and Retrocade Magazine at retrocademagazine.com. Of course, again, if you're on the TV show, then you'll be able to see that, bring that right up. And this is a classic gaming magazine by classic gamers for classic gamers, which sounds like a really familiar slogan. I think we've used that a couple of times. Anyway, so essentially what they have here is a realistic-looking magazine that you can purchase and buy online, digital copy, of course, in PDF format. Doesn't look like there's any sort of protection or anything. So for those of you who actually want to look at it on something else other than your PC, you'll be able to do that. And let's see if I can find some further information here for you. Oh, this is endorsed by Todd Rogers. This is nice. Todd Rogers says, I'm pleased to see all this work and effort to support the gaming community and the gaming passion. Retrocade Magazine is the tops. So it looks pretty good. I mean, it's nice to see, if nothing else, that somebody is keeping things alive in a classic medium like print, even though it's technically not print. Oh, there's a preview here. Let's see, a full article. Let me take a look at the preview here. We're going to do this in real time so that you can share the love with me. Retrocade Magazine. We'll see what kind of quality we got in here, because you know I don't want to talk about it and point you in that direction if it's not top-notch. Issue, preview number one of issue number one. Let's see. And you guys can follow along with me if you've got the browser window. This is a pretty choice. They actually have ads from classic games and magazines. Here's an ad for Activision Tennis. And we have our table of contents here. Some high scores. It looks like they have a high score type deal that they print the high scores. Retro charts, popularity of the charts, most popular coin-operated video games, retro boards. And here's our first article by Rob Mayers. Let me pronounce that right. George Riley takes on Junior and King of All Kongs. And it's your standard two-column format, some interview action, some more retro ads thrown in here. This looks fun. This looks like a fun little magazine. So head on over to RetrocadeMagazine.com or check it out in RGR Plus TV. We'll have that there for you. Pretty neat. Well, thanks, Kevin, for sending that in. Next up, Gary Adamson sends us in a website for Amstrad CPC reviews. Now, okay, let's be honest. I don't know a lot about the Amstrad. And let's be honest, I don't know a lot about a lot of the equipment that was popular over in the UK and Europe, unless it was the Commodore 64 or the Amiga, and the Amiga seemed to have gotten a lot of love over there. I don't know much about it. Well, with the incessant need to help educate me on this, I was sent over the CPC game review site. And this looks like they've got absolutely tons of not only reviews of classic Amstrad CPC games, but also advertisements that you can see. And that's always fun to me. That's some of the most fun it is looking at some of these old magazines. Looks like it's not super happy in Google Chrome, though. So I might have to take a look at this in another browser. But the content actually ends up linking up, and this looks fun. I mean, again, I can't really comment a whole lot on the whole Amstrad craze, but I do remember hearing tons of people back in the old retro gaming radio days, as well as on our forums and in discussion groups, chat rooms and whatnot, about the Amstrads and some of the Spectrum machines. And frankly, you know, they just didn't work out over here. Apparently they had higher resolution in many cases than, say, the Commodore 64 and whatnot. Let's see. Does it have a full list here? List of games reviewed. And there's a lot. There's a lot of games reviewed on here. My goodness. The list just keeps going. Let me grab one here at random. Let's take a look. Something that I might recognize. Let's see. What about, let's see, is there a Robotron? Here's a Rolling Thunder. That'll work. Rolling Thunder got a 3. Maybe that's not a good idea. Okay, so let's see, Rolling Thunder. It gets basically about, it gives you a screenshot, a link for more information at some other database, as well as a quick one or two paragraph write-up. Pretty cool. For those of you who are looking to relive and rekindle some of your Amstrad days, it looks like we've got the site for you, provided to us by Gary Adamson. Thanks, Gary, for sending that one in. Next up, BJ Wunlin, longtime fan of the show, I know, longtime fan. Wanted to send in something called the Hyperkin Retro N3. Now, this is another, shall we say, clone or knockoff for the classic retro gaming community. Now, a lot of times we've seen knockoffs of NESs, right? You see them at the kiosks at the mall. Some of them you see have SNES ones. But very few of them you see are Genesis ones, although they do exist. But now the Retron 3 promises not just NES and Super NES, but Genesis as well. Quick overview. Capable of playing Nintendo, Sega Genesis, and Super Nintendo cartridge, the Retro N3 is the only system you can play thousands of classic games from these three systems. Compatible with original Nintendo, Sega Genesis, or Super Nintendo controllers. Two original controller ports for each gaming platform, interestingly enough, S-Video and Composite AVI outs includes two wireless controllers, battery not included, and Vector Red or Charcoal Gray in color. Now, I'm assuming that Alex is going to have one of the videos that they've included on their site playing in the background while we're talking about this. If this does the job, this would definitely provide a very useful tool for the retro gaming community. Price on this guy is $70, which, you know, it's pricey, but it's not out there. And it looks like it's got enough buttons to support a six-button joystick for the Genesis, which is perfect. And let's see. Tap into the joy of your childhood with Retro N3 game system. Check out the YouTube videos below. And, of course, we've got a whole bunch of coverages here from other vendors, such as G4 TV and Gizmodo. So it looks like there's a lot of people who've already looked at this guy. So, hey, if anybody's actually has one of these things or is purchasing one, let me know. I would love to get more coverage on this because this would definitely be a super sweet addition to my own personal collection. That's the Retron 3 from Hyperkin. The Play Well, Live Well is their thing. It looks like they have all sorts of other stuff, too. Adapters and chargers and cases and controllers and cables and whatnot for a multitude of classic and current consoles. So they might have some other good stuff to offer up. Thanks, BJ. That was a great addition to the show this month. And as we move along, next up, Gary Garcia passed away this month. Most of you probably don't know the man personally. He, if the name doesn't ring a bell with you, it's not shocking. He was one half of Buckner and Garcia, those famous for the Pac-Man Fever soundtrack that was all the rage back in the 80s, made an interesting retro comeback with a new release of the album a handful of years back. And they were pretty much, they were the Weird Al of video game music. Essentially, they were the ones that went to the arcade and recorded a bunch of sound effects and then wrote cute little bubblegum pop songs around them. I happen to be a big fan of Berserk and Do the Donkey Kong myself. Pac-Man Fever was an okay song. I thought there were some better songs on the soundtrack. Now I've got the song stuck in my head. Maybe we can have Alex produce some audio of that, and you guys can listen to it in the background at your own pace. Hey, it'd be interesting to see if Google Music has this. I've been kind of getting into the Google Music thing lately, seeing if they've got the old stuff that I'm into. That would be cool because the cool thing about Google Music is once you have it, you can share it in Google Plus with your friends for free. So let me see if Pac-Man Fever makes an appearance in here. So much for that idea. All right, well, anyway, so Buckner and Garcia, the duo, one half is gone now. Gary Garcia has moved on to the great arcade in the sky. And there's an interesting story I can give you with this. Way back when Retro Gaming Radio was first in its early incarnation as Retro Radio, and it had a scarily large audience, larger than it has now, and kind of everybody knew what Retro Gaming Radio was or what Retro Radio was, I thought maybe Buckner and Garcia would be interested in doing a little tune for the intro of Retro Gaming Radio. I was always looking for something new, and I'm not exactly a musical genius, as you can tell by my own intros to the show. And I did not get Garcia, by the way. I got Buckner as my reply. And I'll be honest with you, the guy wasn't exactly, shall we say, generous and fun-loving as I'd hoped. He made it very clear that they don't enter the studio for anything less than $5,000. And if I was interested in having something cut, then, you know, that would be the starting point of the negotiations. I don't know if they actually knew the show or not, that, you know, this was a poor man's show, that we didn't have that kind of bank laying around, but it was very, I'm sure that they get lots of fan mail, but it was very kind of short and not exactly as gracious as I'd hoped. But obviously, you know, that wasn't Garcia, that was the Buckner side that I got from that. But anyway, so that was sent in, by the way, from multiple sources. Most people who are into the classic gaming community know all about Gary Garcia's passing, but for those of you who did not, I wanted to pass it along on the show. Last up is a little something from me, which I'm hoping I'm going to get an opportunity to review on a future show, so I don't want to talk too much about it. The Atari Flashback units, they're essentially small versions of the Atari 2600, have no cartridge port, but they have games built into them. The original Atari Flashback was, shall we say, not good. In fact, we've talked about it on the Retro Gaming Radio show. It was not good. Not good at all. It wasn't very accurate emulation. It used a sort of an NES on a chip thing. The games kind of sucked. But the Atari Flashback 2 was a phenomenally decent unit, and many people, in fact, were able to cut a little hole in it and mount a cartridge port on it. That's how good it was. It was really an Atari in there, and they were able to make that sucker work as a real Atari. Now, the Atari Flashback 3 looks exactly the same as the other units. This features 60 built-in games, two 2600 controllers, of course, plug and play into your television, AC adapter powered, has a pause function during the game so you can actually stop the game anywhere. And I'm not going to run through the entire list of titles here, because that would be horrifying, but I'm going to poke through here. A lot of these are the same things we just keep seeing, right? You know how it is. Atari only has the property rights to a certain number of games, and it looks like most of them are in here. Let's see. Adventure, of course. Adventure 2. Asteroids. Battle Zone. Canyon Bomber Centipede. Circus Atari. Combat. Combat 2. Demons to Diamonds. This is not all-inclusive, folks. I'm just kind of going through and looking at the ones that I personally think are great games. Haunted House. Human Cannonball, that was one of my favorite games. Missile Command, Outlaw, that's nice to see that one on there. All the Real Sports series seems to be in here. Skydiver, Space War, Steeplechase, I'm thinking of Stampede, never mind. Stampede was Activision, that was awesome. Super Breakout, Sword Quest, Earth and Fire, but no Water World. How about that? Of course, the video checkers, chess, and pinball, which always has to appear on here, and, of course, the coveted Yars Revenge. So I'm not sure it would be the most exciting console to own. What we really need to do is see Atari have these guys get together with Activision and work us out the Atari Activision console. Then we would have something going on. But at some point, I'm going to lay my hands on one of these when they're not $65, and I'll give you a review of it later on. Well, listen, folks, I hope you enjoyed it. That was Bits and Bytes this month. Remember, send an email to Bits, Bytes, or Bits and Bytes, either way, whichever way you remember it. Send an email to bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. Send us in your Bits and Bytes. We'll probably put it on the air. We don't put everything necessarily on the air, of course, but we will certainly give you kudos when we do. So this stuff is provided by you guys. We throw in some bones here and there, but for the most part, it's submitted by you guys, and we appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed this month's Bits and Bytes. This month, we're going to review this interesting little piece of hardware called the Sega Genesis Gopher Handheld Gaming System. Now, this gaming system goes by many names. You may have seen it, never saw the word Gopher. I don't even know where Gopher comes from. It goes by many names. It goes by the Sega Genesis Sapphire. It goes by what's the other thing I've seen it called? The FireCore. There's a number of different names that this little device goes by. But it's a small portable device. It's orange and black. It's got like a 3-inch screen on it, 6 buttons and a D-pad. What this little guy promises to be is the ultimate Sega Genesis gaming system. Now, there's a couple things that sets this apart from the standard fare of portable hack job retro gaming platforms. Let's go back for just a second. So one of the biggest rages that has been going on within the last decade or so are retro games that have been retrofitted to run on the NES on a chip, or a very cheap sort of graphical chipset that you see in these Jack-specific TV games. You know what I'm talking about. They have some sort of a retro-looking controller. It's got a couple wires you plug into your TV, and they give you some semblance of a classic game, like Pac-Man or Mappy or any number of different things. And they've got a whole bunch of custom IPs, too, like SpongeBob and Spider-Man, which actually works okay for those because you don't have some level of expectation. Now, you've heard us blast on the JAK-specific ones in the past because they're not real, true emulation. So the Holy Grail, first of all, is to start off with something that has true emulation, not some sort of hacked together, just compatible enough to run the five games that are included. The other sad part about these sort of devices is that fact that it usually comes with the same five or six games that we've seen time and time again. For Intellivision, you have their standard fare of games that you always see. Atari stuff has their standard fare of games. And it's all, you know, due to licensing. You know, Sega owns a handful of games, Atari owns a handful of games. So they provide you with what they have. And that's why you only see five or six games used over and over again. Now, this neat little gem comes with not five, not ten, but 20 built-in games from the Sega Genesis. Some of you may know it as the Mega Drive over in Europe. And some of these, of course, are your standard, you know, we've seen them before fair, but there's a lot of actually very decent titles in here that you don't see very often, along with a couple of filler titles, of course. So the Gopher handheld promises the following built-in games: Alex Kidd, Alien Storm, Altered Beast, Aero Flash, Columns 3, Crackdown, Decap Attack, Mean Bean Machine, Echo, Echo Jr., E-SWAT, Flicky, Game Ground, Golden Axe, one of my personal favorites, Jewel Master, Kid Chameleon, Shadow Dancer, Shinobi 3, Sonic & Knuckles, and Sonic Spinball. A rather decent lineup for one of these sort of devices. So, of course, how's the emulation, right? That's the important part. And how does this unit differ from the numerous other types of plug-in TV-type devices? Well, the first thing about this device that you'll notice from a hardware perspective is it's got its own built-in screen. Most of the devices you're seeing nowadays come out or are designed to be plugged into your TV at very, very low resolution. And that kind of ruins some of the fun, right? You're playing Sonic the Hedgehog in this giant blocky mess on your 46-inch LED television. It doesn't turn out very good. But on a smaller screen where the resolution, the native resolution, could be a little better, that's where this unit pretty much flies off the table. And we're going to get to more of that in a minute. The other nice thing about this little device is it contains one thing that I haven't ever seen in one of these sort of, if you want to call them kiosk stand type devices, is a rechargeable lithium ion battery. Now that's crazy, and it's removable. So they intended you at some point to replace this battery. That's interesting to me. Right, a simple one screw opens up the case, and you'll see this in the video that's playing on RGR TV if you're watching on the channel. You can actually remove this lithium ion battery and replace it. That's really cool. It recharges through a standard mini USB plug right on the top, nothing proprietary. And that amazes me. That alone, you know, speaks they wanted you to keep this unit around for a little while. As you start looking around the device from a hardware point of view, the thing's probably, I don't know, about 6.5 inches long, about 4 inches tall, and maybe 3/4 of an inch to an inch thick. So it's very small. It's very lightweight. That's very nice. I mean, this is not something you would feel burden carrying around. Along the front, of course, is the D-pad, which is more of the eight-directional type D-pad versus the four-directional one. In other words, it's actually has plastic in between the four directions. Six buttons for actual control. So those of you who are big into Sega Genesis fighting games that need six buttons, you've got it. Two buttons flank along the top that are hard to see is the menu button and the start pause button. And the menu button obviously is sort of a hard reset, so if you're in the middle of a game, you hit that button, you're taken back to the menu. And the start button is exactly what you would think it is, which is start. It also pauses the game, which is kind of nice. You have a built-in pause feature. There's no save states or anything that you might be used to seeing in a common variety PC emulator. But, you know, just being able to pause the game is pretty nice, especially if you're taking this on the road. Along the bottom, we have a headphone jack. It's very smart. It's actually on the bottom, not on the top or on the side. And a nice, clean, hard, very high-quality feeling on-off switch. A lot of people may remember the Sega Nomad, which was Sega's own portable Sega Genesis emulator, or Sega Genesis system, if you will. It suffered from some very bad build quality problems, right? The power switch, the plug where the AC adapter plugs in was very, very poor. The screen itself wasn't even all that great. And while it did allow for you to plug in an extra controller, it was kind of pointless, you know. I mean, you and your friend could play Mortal Kombat on this little tiny screen, but one of you's using the screen as his controller. So definitely a disadvantage. It's a neat concept, and these things fetch a very high price on the market, and they're hard to find one that's in really good shape, you know, without a cracked screen cover or a fully working screen or an on-off switch that's not ready to fall out. So that's kind of a holy grail for Sega Genesis fans, right? It's the Sega Nomad. This device is more or less the Sega Nomad, except for instead of taking full-size cartridges, which the Sega Genesis Nomad did, this takes, get this, an SD card. Now, when I saw this at the store, and it said, play your own games on SD card, I'm thinking there has to be some sort of a catch. This just couldn't really be a device that you could just throw some ROMs on a card and plug it in and just turn it on and have it work, right? That's not possible. Well, you'll find out in a minute. Along the top of the device is a charging light, the mini USB slot, to plug in your power to charge, an AV out plug. Now, this looks like the standard 1/8 inch AVI cable. Now, I didn't have a chance to test it on the television, just for the same reason I mentioned earlier, is that I just can't stand playing, 320 by 200 games on this giant ass screen. But the AV out plug looks like a standard one that you see on most electronics. So I'm betting that if you have one of those 1/8 inch jack plugs, it'll work fine. The SD card slots along the top. And finally, the volume control. Now, this guy has pretty good volume. A lot of people are like, well, you know, it always sounds terrible, these little devices. This actually has remarkably decent sound. Now, when you start cranking the sound really high, it does have a built-in speaker. When you start cranking the sound really high, it does start to muffle a little bit. But the sound level is absolutely perfect with a minimal amount of volume put forward. And if you have headphones on, that would probably be a completely moot point. On one side, you do have a little pass-through strap holder device that you can, you know, route yourself wrist strap or an arm strap for. What about the build of this device? How does it feel in your hand? Well, it's very lightweight. It doesn't feel too cheap. That's what I like about it. The buttons are very tactile. They feel solid. They respond quickly to your actions. The D-pad is even a very decent quality. Now, I wouldn't call it high quality. But you know what these vendor, kiosk vendor, over-the-counter, crappy pseudo-emulation devices usually have very crappy controls. They're designed to be thrown away. Putting your thumb on this D-pad and moving it around, you know that this thing's going to last for a while and that the build is relatively decent. So I wouldn't call it a super high-quality build. I wouldn't call it a low-quality build either. I would call it somewhere in the mid-range where you're not going to feel bad about playing it because you think you're going to break it. And that's it. Let's talk about the screen, right? A lot of people want to know, what does the screen look like? The screen is remarkable. It's gorgeous. The colors pop out. It looks fantastic. The viewing angle is probably not as good as it could be, right? I'm looking at it right now. The viewing angle's not great. But if you're dead on to it, which is, you know, you're going to be doing, the screen is beautiful. The screen is absolutely gorgeous. It is higher quality screen than I would expect to see in a device such as this. And you'll be able to see it, too, on the video. Even though the video is going to be kind of small and low quality, you'll be able to tell right off the bat that this is a high-quality-looking screen. Another thing about the screen is it's very bright. It doesn't look dim like the old Nomads did. And there's no ghosting or shadowing-type smearing effect when you have action games. You run along in Golden Axe, nothing smears, nothing tears, it all looks clean. Again, speaks wonders about this unit. Now, once you power up and you get to the main menu, there's two menus to choose from. There's 10 games on each menu. And then finally, if you move over to the third menu page, it gives you an SD card option. And let's talk about the SD card. The SD card, which does stick out slightly when it's inside the unit, I mean, not much, I mean, barely any. I mean, but if you run your finger along the top, you would feel the card sticking out. Certainly not a showstopper. It's not like it's sticking out like a big giant cartridge. One thing you will notice about this unit is that it will only accept a low-density, low-capacity SD card. So 2 gigabytes or the rare 4 gigabyte one that is not an HC or a high-capacity card. So you might have to do some digging around to dig yourself up a 2 gig standard SD, not micro SD, but a standard SD card. Fortunately, I had one sitting in my Nintendo 3DS, which I pulled out, plugged into my computer, and I dropped a handful of game ROMs on. Now, I'm going to power this guy up real quick, just so I can get to the list of games that I did try on it. And again, like I said, it's amazing the quality of the screen. It just blows me away. Once you hit SD, it does search the card for the items. Now, they'll only accept unzipped bin files. So if you've got them in other formats, that's not going to help you. You will have to get bin file versions of them. It looks like it will hold, it'll hold at least, I would say, 9 pages of games. Now, I put like 27 games on here, okay, guys? And I tried out a handful of them. Some of them, you know, more popular than others. I tried Mortal Kombat 2, which is one of my favorite. Prince of Persia. And you'll see all these on the video, by the way. Prince of Persia I tried out. Shadow of the Beast. And Turrican. I tried those out. But I've tried Lion King before on this because that's one of my favorite, platformers just because I'm a big fan of Lion King. Once you select the game, it does take a moment or two to load, and it gives you a nice little loading game screen. And as it loads the ROM, it builds up a little progress meter. The game loads up, and you're immediately thrown into what looks like a Sega Genesis. It blows me away still just how good the quality of the screen is. Let me see here. So I loaded up the Lion King here just so I had an idea. Everything is very crisp and clear. Remember the GBA Micro? Remember how that had such a great screen for being as small as it was? This looks like it's cut from the same cloth. It really does. Some games, most of the games, in fact, I didn't find any game that didn't work right or have proper sound. Although I do remember when I first got this device, a couple of the game ROMs that I had were corrupted. And I don't know exactly how to tell if they're corrupted or not. All I know is I put them in, and when I booted the game up, I had some graphical glitches. I obtained the ROMs from a different source, and they were fine. So if you find a game that provides unsatisfactory results, you may try getting them from a different source. So, am I saying what you think I'm saying? Is this really a Sega Nomad with brand new technology, a crisp new screen, and plays game ROMs right off of an SD card? That's exactly what I'm saying. We have now the official Sega Nomad successor, and I would not hesitate for a second to recommend this device to anybody who's into Sega Genesis. Now, there's probably a couple of restrictions that you're going to run into at some point. First of all, you're probably only going to be able to get 127 games on this card, right? That's a limitation of the file system, I would imagine. Now, I haven't tested this theory, but suffice to say, I would presume you're going to get 127 games, which is going to nowhere near meet the 2 gigabyte size requirement of the card. So don't feel bad, oh, I can only have a 2 gig card. Dude, it's Sega Genesis games. You know what I'm saying? These things are not big at all. Let me see if I can give you an idea. I'll give you an idea just how big these games are, so you can feel better about only being able to use a 2 gigabyte card in here. Let me bring this up for you. Okay, so here we go. Inside the game folder, the biggest game that I see in here is 4 megabytes. And that's Sonic and Knuckles and Sonic 3. Sonic and Knuckles and Sonic 3. That's the biggest game that there is in here. Most of the games clock in at 1 megabyte or less, including Golden Axe 3 and Fatal Rewind, Sonic the Hedgehog, Rev 1. So there you go. This is it, guys. You've been waiting for this for a long time. A portable, high-quality Sega Genesis Nomad replacement that uses SD card technology to pump your favorite games onto this beautiful little screen. decent quality build controls, build quality on the controls, right? That's huge. That's important. And a lithium ion battery to boot. This is a no-brainer device, folks. If you are a retro gamer, you almost have to have one of these. Now, here's the best part. Now, most of the time when you find a super high-quality device like this, it's available from one place, and that's overseas somewhere. You got to wait 9 weeks to get it. You're going to pay some horrible import tax on it. It's going to cost you $200. That's just absolutely crazy. Now, this device is widespread. You can get it everywhere, including Amazon. I've seen it at Best Buy. I've seen it at Fry's Electronics. I think if I remember right, I've even seen it at Walgreens, which is a popular drugstore. And I've also, I think I may have seen it at Toys R Us at one point too. So this is a high distribution device. And as such, the pricing is decent. I've seen it as low as $35, and I've seen it as high as $50. Either way, even $50 for what is essentially a brand new technology Sega Nomad, that's a no-brainer. Right now it's going for $45 plus about $7 shipping from Amazon. And it's shipped and sold by somebody called G Dreamer. If you've got, now this is obviously not Amazon Prime eligible. If you got a local store, go check out your local stores. See who has this thing. Because it's, you want it. Trust me, you want this thing. If nothing else, a portable Sega Genesis that you can plug into a TV. Now, what you're not going to get is a second controller, right? This is the only downside of this unit. There is no place to plug in a second Genesis controller. So plugging it into the TV, firing up Mortal Kombat 2, you and your friend still don't get to play. But you do get the ability to use the six-button controller, which is more than you get from most of these Sega Genesis-type things. So, at the end of the day, this device gets a huge thumbs up. It's a staple, or it should be a main staple in anybody's collection of retro gaming related product, especially at the price, right? This is a gorgeous screen. If the screen wasn't absolutely brilliant and the build quality wasn't staggering and the sound sucked and there wasn't a built-in rechargeable battery, I would say $45 might be a little high. But come on, I mean, look at what you got. This is an incredible device. I can't recommend it enough. And of course, if you're into Sega Genesis, I mean, if you have no desire to play Sega Genesis games, then this device does nothing for you. But, hey, I'm telling you, I love it. Mine sits within arm's reach pretty much any time. I have a dedicated 2-gig card. Usually, I snaked it for something else. But normally, I have a 2-gig card in it all the time. And if you don't have the card in it, you still have at least 5 or 6 top-notch games built in, as well as a handful of decent games and a couple of games that you'll probably never play. Again, this is called the Sega Genesis Gopher. It's also known as the Fire Core, the Arcade Ultimate, and the Sapphire. Again, I've got a link for you right on the RGR Plus TV site. Right now, you should be seeing it in your display. Pop it out, add it to your bookmarks, pick it up later, or go to your local electronics store and see if they've got it. They probably do. All right, gang, that's going to wrap it up for the November 2011 edition. Special thanks go out to everybody who sent in Bits and Bytes segments. Also, Alex J. Lopez, my tireless producer, who's bringing you all those cool video clips you're seeing on the RGR Plus TV window. Thanks to all the listeners. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.